Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our title today, A Company Family, The Untold History of Obama and the CIA. Now to my guest, Jeremy Kusmaroff from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And by the way, he is the managing editor of what I consider one of the most important consumer activist publications in the United States, Covert Action Magazine, a 40-plus-year-old publication that hosts a number of extraordinary writers and journalists covering current events. He is the author of four books on U.S. foreign policy, including Obama's Unending Wars from Clarity Press and The Russians Are Coming Again. And the magazine's website is covertactionmagazine.com. And Jeremy can be reached at jkuzmarov2@gmail.com. His book is Obama's Unending Wars. Nice to have you with us today, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me.
I read your article, A Company Family, The Untold History of Obama and the CIA, in the October 1st, 2021 edition of Covert Action Magazine. And here's what you say, and I'm just going to read just a few of the paragraphs, and then we'll unfold this entire very complex story. Quote, in the summer of 2012, President Barack Obama signed a secret order authorizing the CIA and other U.S. agencies to support rebels in Syria seeking to oust Syrian leader Bashar Assad, a nationalist who had allied with Iran and stood up to U.S. See, Israel. Costing more than $1 billion, Operation Timber Sycamore evolved into the largest covert operation since the arming of the Mujahideen fighters in Afghanistan in the 1980s. U.S. Special Forces under Timber Sycamore again trained Islamic fundamentalists, this time in Jordan, who again carried out a reign of terror. A voracious consumer of intelligence, Obama's trademark throughout his presidency was to move war into the shadows, a light footprint approach designed to expand U.S. power covertly. General Joseph Votel, head of the Special Operations Command, SOCOM, characterized the Obama era as, quote, golden age for special operations. Green Berets were deployed in 133 countries, 70% of the world, in 2014 alone. In a meeting about Afghanistan, Obama told CIA Director Leon Panetta that the CIA would, quote, get everything it wanted, end quote. So, that's just a small part of the opening. So, Jeremy, we're going to ask you to unfold this. For example, right at the top, I would assume that since the Obama administration and the CIA were funding special operatives to be carried out against Syria, were these in any way themselves terrorists, or could they be designated, or had they ever been designated by the State Department as terrorists? And if the answer is yes, then what then is the moral responsibility for using individuals who it was clear were committing acts of killing people, beheading people, if that's the case? So let us unfold all this so we understand what is behind this new reign of terror. The forum is yours.
Okay, sure. Well, yeah, I think it's well established and documented that they were terrorists, and that's why the majority, polls show that the majority of Syrians did support the Assad government, and they were violent from the outset, and they were, Islamic fundamentalists. And, historically, there had been an uprising in Syria in the 1980s under Hafez, Bashar al-Assad's father, and was also an Islamic rebellion that the Assads had accused at that time the CIA of supporting. So, I mean, the fissure in Syrian politics is between the Ba'athist, secular Arab nationalist government of the Assad dynasty, and their main rivals have been Islamic fundamentalists. Much like in Syria, the main opponents of Muammar Gaddafi were Islamic fundamentalists. And the Western media, I think, distorted and presented as a purely democratic uprising when it was dominated by these Islamic groups from the beginning. And, you know, I think even Biden admitted at one point, that there weren't many moderates, or that, you know, the aid was going to extremists who carried out terrorist activities. And one can compare it maybe to the 80s with Afghanistan, where the CIA was training Islamic fundamentalists to fight a pro-Soviet government in Afghanistan. And the scale of funding, I think, was not far removed from that.
When we look at some of the hallmarks of how he did this without anyone in the mainstream media that is prone to accepting leaks, official leaks, which are actually illegal from governmental agencies, but it never is prosecuted unless it's a whistleblower, then it is prosecuted. But no one from the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, NBC, ABC, none of these mainstream journalists showed any inclination towards exposing this, and yet it was not a great secret.
Yeah, it's disturbing. And yeah, I should add that a lot of the some of the funding came through Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia, you know, supporting, you know, has exported terrorism across the Middle East. And you're right. I mean, I think it was shameful that the mainstream media was not delving into this. Actually, from what I've read, it's similar in the 1980s. You know, even the progressive groups, the American left in the 80s, was focused on Central America and El Salvador for good reason. But there was very limited opposition to what the U.S. government was doing in Afghanistan in the 80s. And you see that again with Syria, that the left-wing groups, you know, have their own causes they take up, and most of them are justified. But I think a lot of the left was divided about Syria, and some bought into this narrative about Assad being this butcher. And I think the mainstream media just promoted, you know, I think at one point Trump called Assad an animal, and that's almost the way he was presented in the media, you know, purely demonized. And even progressive media were doing this. And yeah, the mainstream media was just, you know, completely uniform in its one-sided coverage, and in failing to investigate what was going on, the nature of U.S. allies, and failing to educate readers about the nature of Syrian politics and how historically it was divided between Baathists and Islamic jihadist groups.
When you take a look at how every piece fit together, and that's what this audience needs, we need to see all the pieces fitting together, first to implement it, and then to keep it secret, and then to blame Assad or other agents out there for anything that went wrong. Show us how they put it together, who the people were, as best as you know, and also the organizations, and who else might have participated in this that we wouldn't think would have participated in funding, protecting, arming, and training terrorists, something the American public would not accept, to carry out this agenda. And what was the ultimate agenda? What was so important about Syria, since it was already in a terrible drought, and outside of oil, what else would have been our motive for going in there and engaging in regime change?
Well, to the last question, I think there was the Assad dynasty was long hated by groups in the national security establishments, and especially the so-called neoconservative groups, because it was more of an independent government. The Assad Hafez was strongly allied with the Soviet Union and was also allied with the Nasserist. Initially, I think, had some ties with the Nasserist government in Egypt, which had tried to form a union with Syria. And it was Hafez was more of a socialist. So, you know, a socialist government that was trying to assert Syrian control over the oil and link up with other Arab countries to form pan-Arab union that would, you know, assert a stronger Middle East and be able to stand up to Western countries. And both Assad, you know, stood up to Israel, because Israel took over the Golan Heights, I believe, after the Six-Day War in 1967, which is a part of Syria. And the Syrian view is occupied territory by the Israelis. And Assad, you know, always stood up to the Israelis and couldn't always be pushed around by the Israelis. So I think there's, you know, numerous interests at play here, but there's really an interest in creating more pliable government that would be allied with the West, that would be more acquiescent to the Israelis, and that would, you know, offer Western corporations access to its oil. And, you know, Rumsfeld, in 2002, was pretty explicit in developing this plan of overthrowing numerous Middle East governments, you know, starting with Iraq. And of course, Iran was the ultimate prize of overthrowing that Islamic regime in Iraq, in Iran. But Syria was on that list and was a key country. They wanted to remove the Assads and put in a pliable pro-Western leader. And I think in Islamic, the fundamentalists were more acceptable than, and historically the U.S. has supported fundamentalism over Arab socialism or pan-Arabism that the Assad represented, even though Bashir was less of a socialist than his father and was moving to privatize a lot of state industry, but he was still independent and somewhat defiant Western countries and interests. So I think there's the motive. It's a long historical motive of removing that government going back, you know, several administrations. And I think Saudi Arabia was important because I think the U.S. government has become very skilled in using proxies to support its interests and kind of shielding the public from foreign policies that are rather dubious, as you point out. And most Americans probably wouldn't support if they knew everything. So it's carried out very covertly. And the Saudis are key agents in providing a lot of the funding. And a lot of the training was carried out in Jordan. And Turkey was also important. So the kind of martial alliance of countries to support this initiative. And yeah, covert training was carried out in Jordan as well as Turkey.
One issue that has always remained unresolved, but at the time we were doing, Richard Yell and myself were doing investigations into Benghazi, because something didn't make sense. It doesn't take 13 hours to get support troops from different countries into Libya, to that particular compound, and yet we were told that nothing else could be done. And yet later, different people said that there was a stand-down order, or they could have gotten there and saved lives. Is it possible that the reason that there was not a rescue in a timely manner, which led to Ambassador Stevens' death, is because there was a secret effort that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were both aware of, the Defense Department, the military was fully aware of, the State Department aware of, to smuggle Gaddafi's weapons that had been confiscated into Benghazi, into the mission, and then secretly take them into Syria to arm the rebels or terrorists, and that would have been against international law and would have been a really big gaffe politically if the world knew that we allowed Americans to die so that a secret operation would have been covered up. What do you have to add to that?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And I think Stephen was crucial to that whole operation. And I read one report that said he was, you know, very comfortable, you know, breaking bread with guerrillas. So, I mean, they presented him as this kind of Boy Scout from Berkeley. But really, I think he was knee deep in these covert operations, both in Libya and in Syria. And that therein lies, I think, the secret to what you're saying, the cover up surrounding his death.
Do you have any evidence that there was ample opportunity to get rescue troops in there?
I don't know too much more than what's been reported in other sources. I don't have any insider knowledge of it, but I think you're on the right track, yeah, with your assessment. And yeah, it certainly begs for more investigation.
Now let's take a different approach, if you would, please. Give us your understanding of how Obama was able to, in fact, engage in disingenuous dialogue about seeking peace when, in point of fact, under his 8-year regime, there were 7 separate wars going on that he was responsible, in no small measure, for continuing, and yet he's still considered this wise, sage, you know, this Nobel Prize, Peace Prize winner, when all the evidence points to just the opposite. Could you unpack that with some details?
Sure. Yeah. And firstly, I think sometimes people project something onto a leader that they want him to be, and he's not actually that person. And then, you know, they become very disillusioned. In his case, well, in my book, I compare him with Woodrow Wilson. I think Wilson pioneered this kind of rhetoric of, you know, humanitarianism, you know, especially when Wilson sent the U.S. Troops into World War One. He framed it as part of this humanitarian mission that would, you know, it would be a war to end all wars and a war to spread democracy, and that it was necessary to help establish the League of Nations and American leadership in the world that could allow the League of Nations and its principles to be effective, and that, you know, the U.S. Again, was serving this noble purpose overseas and countering German autocracy. And I think, you know, Obama followed, and it was not necessarily that different from other liberal presidents that we've seen, but I think he was very effective. Some of it may have been the fact that, as, you know, an African-American, people saw him as a moral beacon because he had, you know, cracked that barrier. And again, they maybe projected onto him something of their own value system. So they bought into the rhetoric that was very Wilsonian, and that packaged, I think in part he drew off certain, you know, intellectual like Samantha Power, who was in his administration, you know, had written this book, A Problem from Hell, about how America, you know, did nothing to stop these genocides. So when Obama was, you know, supporting the NATO operations in Libya, he framed it as, you know, necessity in stopping genocide, and we can't let, you know, another Rwanda to happen. And that seemed to resonate people because they had heard over and over again how the U.S. did nothing, you know, and stood by in Rwanda, and Power had promoted that in her book, even though the situation in Rwanda was a lot more complex than Power had led people to believe. And in fact, you know, the U.S. was involved in Rwanda and supporting one faction, the Tutsi, who killed a lot of people as much as the Hutu. But most of the public may not have been as informed on those details. So I think he played off this kind of rhetoric and intellectual analysis that seemed to resonate with people, and framed these interventions as being, you know, noble and for humanitarian causes. And it worked, just like it worked for Wilson, who the public initially did support him, and all of the dissenters were thrown in jail, although eventually people woke up and realized it's been a big mistake. And maybe some are waking up now with some of the disasters in the Middle East provoked by U.S. interventions. But the other aspect is that a lot of this was done very covertly. So it wasn't as, you know, American were less invested, like in the era of the First World War, you know, there was a draft and people, you know, either were subjected to the draft themselves or had friends or family going over. So they paid more careful attention. In the modern era, I think the American government has become, since Vietnam, very successful in distancing the American people from the wars it fights, by relying on, you know, a small professional army and relying on, you know, high-tech gadgets and drones and proxy forces. And Obama was certainly a specialist in that. So Americans weren't paying really that close attention.
But we're supposed to have the American media be there to watch over all this. And there was a time when it did. The Church Committee hearings really was a game changer as far as the CIA being able to get away with what it wanted to get away with without any cause and effect. The Dulles brothers were also earlier a part of that mix. But then in came Obama with the promise of hope and change. And then we start seeing the security state and all the security agencies have even more power. In fact, he was instrumental in the National Defense Authorization Act, which for the first time that I'm aware of, granted the president the right to have anyone arrested without due process, without habeas corpus, with no rights, and if he chose to have that person imprisoned indefinitely, and also to assassinate people that, if you remember, became kind of a, oh, it's Tuesday, it's time for the president to meet with his national security advisor and decide who to kill. You know, as if that was a very flippant idea that it's okay to kill someone without due process. And we've seen how much false information in the intelligence occurred and also how they lied under the Obama administration about how many drones were impacting civilians. They minimized the amount of death when it was much higher, a minimum of 400. Some estimates go as far as 1,200. We don't know the exact number, but we know we were lied to as a matter of course. In fact, when he found out, he didn't find out, when he was informed that the, I think it was Snowden, that, but it may not have been, that the intelligence agencies were, the National Security Agency in specific, was illegally listening in on everyone, taking messages and contacts. And yet nothing happened to anyone, and Clapper lied under oath. He lied before Congress, and yet no perjury charge was brought. Brennan lied, head of the CIA. Nothing was done to him, except both of them were hired by CNN and MSNBC. That should tell you a lot about their integrity. And so I'm looking, thinking, wow, this guy got away with everything. He has been held accountable for nothing. But the most egregious act was Libya. Yes, we know about Honduras. We know about the Ukraine. We know about Syria. But most Americans, if you told them, what do you know about Libya? Gaddafi was a terrorist, and he had a terrorist nation. He was ended, and that's good. What if I told you that Libya had the highest literacy rate of any of the 54 countries in Africa? It had an oil channel where oil revenues from the sweet oil came in, his free crude, and was gone into everyone's bank account, that he said he would not live in a home until every Libyan had a home, and so he lived in a tent, as did his parents, that there was free education. Even if you couldn't get the education you wanted in Libya, you could go anywhere in the world, and it would be paid for. If you had medical treatments, it was free, but if you needed medical care outside the Libya, it would be paid for. If you couldn't work, then what you would have made if you're working would have been paid you, that there was no debt. There was over $24 billion in gold, and that he was heading the largest water project in the world in Libya that was going to feed over 180 million African citizens their water from one of the great projects, and that women in Libya had the most freedom of any Muslim women in the world. In fact, it was a crime. You could go to jail if you assaulted, cursed, or in any way disrespected in any violent way women in Libya, and that there were thousands of these small commissions, little mini democracies that made the rules. Now, he was against capital punishment, but some of the people weren't, and so in some of the provinces, they imposed capital punishment because they had that freedom to do so. And yet, overnight, all that he had done, including trying to get the nations of Africa off the gold off the dollar as a reserve currency and go towards the gold denier, that was the final tipping point where he had to go, because the last thing the people in power wanted was the African nations' leadership to start creating their own banking system, no interest banking, etc. And so they destroyed him. And as a result, now you have the UN Council, United Nations, just came back with a scathing report about rapes, killings, torture, enslavement in Libya. And no one, not a single member of the media, not NPR, not PBS, nobody has said, well, how did this happen? What was Obama? And it was Hillary Clinton and other the neocons around them. How is it that you can get away with one of the worst crimes against humanity of any president in history, and you're praised instead of condemned? Please unpack that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a brilliant analysis you're providing. And I mean, I don't have the answers, except that I think a lot of the American public is not that well informed about Africa. And for years, I think the media had demonized Gaddafi. I mean, he had been referred to as the mad dog of the Middle East by Ronald Reagan. And whenever his name was brought up, he was associated with terrorism in the mainstream. And very few, the percentage would be infinitesimal of people who understood what you were saying. and who had a perspective of people who live in Libya or live in Africa about how much he had done for the people and how popular his government had been. And I myself was in Zambia when he visited in 2007, and he was greeted very, very positively. And you know, I learned at that point about how he had also invested in development in the African continent, and he was trying to promote industry in Africa and picking up kind of the torch of the Pan-African movement and African unity. But I only learned that going to Africa, so because I spent some time there. So I think very few Americans understood this. And this, I think they had this narrative hammered home that, oh, the U.S. did nothing, and there was that Rwandan genocide. And that's what was invoked, that we can't allow this to happen again. And Gaddafi's, poised to commit, they claim he was poised to commit genocide in Benghazi. And it was never reported that this was really an Islamic rebellion. Benghazi was a headquarter of Al-Qaeda. That was not reported. And I think it was false. The only massacres, there were no massacres that ever occurred. But I think people were led to believe that there was going to be an imminent genocide. And, the only massacres started when NATO started bombing. And the rebels, these rebel forces were committing major massacres. But the public, I think, had this idea, we have to stop genocide. And that's the kind of rhetoric Obama was adopting. And I think the fact that he was a African-American president, few would question on this, that, few would think, oh, he's going to do harm. I think there was this illusion that he was a friend, of Africans, but really he sold out Africa, with the Afrikaner. I mean, he contributed to the recolonization of Africa, besides what you're describing in Libya. Under his administration, the number of drone bases escalated in U.S. military footprint in Africa increased considerably. So he really was not a friend of Africans. And he kind of fits the tradition that Frantz Fanon had described, black skin, white mask, how kind of white power elite will put a black face to kind of give a progressive veneer to policies that are really selling out black people and perpetuating colonialism or neocolonialism. And I happened to be in Africa when the Libya war broke out. It's interesting to compare the media there and here, because there the headlines were, neo-colonial war, and it was viewed as just a continuation of the colonial era throughout much of Africa. But here, again, it was presented as this great humanitarian undertaking, and it led to, as you pointed out, absolute catastrophe for the Libyans, including the reintroduction of slavery and destruction of all the progressive gains in the Gaddafi era, a great tragedy and crime, as you point out.
You mentioned just a few moments ago, Jeremy, that the average person would not have known the history of Africa. However, the media would. They had bureaus there. So, mm-hmm. And historians would. Professors in universities would have known this. And people engaged in the Foreign Policy Corps would have known this. So we had plenty of people who could have informed, but we didn't. Instead, here's what you wrote that the New York Times reported. Quote, the New York Times reported that in the 67 years since the CIA was founded, few presidents have had as close a bond with their intelligence chiefs as Mr. Obama forged with John Brennan, end quote, an architect of the CIA's extraordinary rendition program, that's torture, and former CIA station chief in Saudi Arabia. Ah. Well, now, there's another piece of this puzzle. During Obama's 8 years in power, Saudi Arabia was never called out for being a terrorist state, and yet it was. There is ample documentation that has been done by some outstanding investigative journalists, for example, calling out the White Helmets as terrorists. Yet you wouldn't know that because of Democracy Now! And other liberal stations and media reported they were heroes. They won an Academy Award for short documentary. And yet, people that I know, Beasley and others who were there, five separate reporters went to Syria, and they found that, oh no, the White Helmets are terrorists. And we, the United States, have contributed over, I believe 1 year it was $100 million, but all told, over that period of time, it was over $500 million. And that's just the United States. Great Britain and others did similarly. I don't know the total amount, but they did. Now, Take a look. Take a look at what the media could easily have found, but it took a Seymour Hersh to say, no, 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 that gas bombing, that poison bomb was not Syria. It was the terrorists there. Then why was the media never doing good reporting? Why were they always coming down on the side of the terrorists and never the truth and always against Assad? And yet that showed us, or at least it showed me, I can only speak for myself, that the media had no integrity, and yet they wouldn't challenge Obama, they wouldn't challenge Hillary Clinton. And when the Podesta emails came through, joined Assange's WikiLeaks, immediately that's when, oh, this is Russia, Russia, Russia. Assange said repeatedly it was not Russia, and he was correct. In fact, the one person that is proven that he gave those documents to was working in the Democratic headquarters in New York or in Washington, D.C., Seth, and he was killed. He was shot, and with a terrible investigation afterwards. And yet he had met privately with former Ambassador Murphy in a park across the street from American University and was handed a whole folder of documents and a thumb drive. And he has so stated that. So we know this. And then 5 or 10 chiefs of former top people, Ray McGovern and others, Wim Benny, said that based upon the size and method of the leak, it could not have come from Russia. They gave the whole explanation why it wasn't possible. But the media refused to pick up on any of these threads. They just refused. Every door you open, they slam shut. And so then came the whole idea of Russia. Now, here's something that's important, because this also is associated, because this was under Obama too. How is it possible that virtually every single major media in America bought into Russia being behind the election, and that everything came from the Steele dossier? All of that 4 separate investigation was proven not to be true. The FISA court was lied to by Comey and other people at the FBI, and yet nothing has happened to any of those people for falsifying documents for a FISA judge. Why have the FISA judges not written a single word on this? Why has there been no protest? Why is it that the Durham investigation found only 2 people, thus far at least, culpable, and yet everybody still believes the lie? They believe the lie of Assad. They believe the lie of Libya. They believe the lie of Ukraine. They believe the lie of non-intervention and non-regime change in Venezuela, all of which are lies. I mean, everything they do is just one lie after another. I don't even know if they know how to tell which day it is without lying. Could you address these connections? Because Obama was a part of those as well.
Yeah, well, yeah, I agree with you. It's really, amazing what they can get away with. Well, I mean, as far as the media, I guess you have to look at who owns the media and what interest they have in promoting certain narratives and political agendas. It's not really news. It's more propaganda. And I think the media had been more open, decades earlier, and that seems to have changed. I think, as far as believing Obama and believing some of these narratives, I think some of it is also tied to the, you have to look at the psychology of people. I mean, the GOP has become a very extreme party that embraces, conspiracy theories and almost like kind of death cult, or in some of the positions it adopts, and it scares a lot of people legitimately. And so I think they get in defensive mode, and they don't want to criticize Obama because he's the last barrier to Bush or Trump, who they see as very dangerous people, I think, legitimately. So, and I don't think that's right. I mean, I think those of us who are liberal, we can strongly oppose the agenda of Trump or the extremism of the current GOP, but we also should call out, and an independent media should call out both parties and report honestly on the lies of both parties. But unfortunately, that's not happening. And I think the other aspect is to look at the CIA and the intelligence agencies and how powerful they've become. I mean, historically, the CIA planted many people within the media, and there were exposés. Bob Woodward did an exposé about that in the 70s, and he found there many, many journalists have been in the pay of the CIA. And I think those efforts have only intensified So a lot of what we read or see in the media is simply coming right out of the CIA. And the CIA, as we've discussed, is tied with Obama and his family. And so they're really running the country, and they're running it in a very bad way. I mean, unethical. They're doing many unethical and criminal things. And they could, you know, use the media to deceive people and use Obama as kind of their instrument, because he's a gifted orator and he speaks well and he's believable. And so he's effective.
Jeremy, you've done something that I'm not aware anyone else has actually done in the scholarship. You've done a remarkable piece of scholarship. Do you mind if I read some of your article directly to the audience?
Sure. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. I'm going to read directly from Jerry's article in Covert Action Quarterly. Everybody should read this, especially those who are liberal and who believe in freedom of speech and freedom of assembly and not having a government that is intruding into our lives, because this is where you can understand how the genesis of this occurred. Quote, Obama's worldview meshed so closely with this unsentimental intel warrior and terrorist hunter that Obama found himself finishing Brennan's sentences. As an anonymous cabinet member explained, quote, presidents tend to be smitten with the instruments of the intelligence community, but Obama was more smitten than most. This has been an intelligence presidency in a way we haven't seen maybe since Eisenhower, end quote. The consequences could be seen in Obama's boosting funding for the National Endowment for Democracy, which promotes regime change in countries defiant of the New World Order, and his drastic expansion of the use of drones for both surveillance and targeted killings. The Obama administration further backed coups in Ukraine and Honduras, pivoted the U.S. military to Asia, ramped up arms sales to Saudi Arabia, and expanded military bases in Africa, helped suppress evidence about CIA torture, refused to pursue a criminal case against the CIA's money laundering bank, HSBC, eavesdropped on U.S. allies and U.S. Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who opposed his administration's illegal invasion of Libya that devastated that country, stepped up surveillance and efforts to destroy WikiLeaks and its founder Julian Assange, and presided over the prosecution of a record number of whistleblowers under the Espionage Act of 1917. Now, as an aside, this is me talking now, I'm not quoting Jeremy. You don't have to be an investigative journalist. You don't have to be a professor. Just common sense and reason. In the entire history of the Espionage Act, President Obama prosecuted more whistleblowers than all the other presidents combined. I believe it was over 17. But here's what's important. Every single one of those whistleblowers was shown to be telling the truth. Their documents were not fabricated. They were exposing crimes against the government that they engaged in. Many of those were crimes against humanity. So now think of this just as a lay person. And the entire media supported Obama. You have people who are risking their freedom, their reputation, even their life, to bring documents forward to show how corrupt a governmental agency is. For risking that, they're put into prison, condemned, and now are excluded and erased. The people committing the crimes who were exposed in the information are never punished. So the criminals are still in that circle of power. Nothing has been denied them. They're protected. So we have a situation where the innocent, the truth tellers, those who risk, the real heroes, are universally punished. And this was also the case with Julian Assange. In 10 million document leaks, he was never found to have given false information. And many of the media used his documents. But now none of those media come to his side in defense, even though what's being done to him has also in itself been a crime, against him. So does that make any sense that all of the people committing crimes are rejoicing because they knew that nothing would happen to them, and the people exposing the crimes go to jail as if they were the real criminals? Now back to what Jeremy was saying. Additionally, the Obama administration protected longtime CIA assets from prosecution, like Rwanda mass murder, Paul Kagame, waged war by proxy in Yemen through the United Arab Emirates. And by the way, as an aside again, they sold nearly $27 billion worth of arms. But Saudi Arabia, during all this, was still beheading people, throwing gays off buildings, giving women no rights at all. In fact, the women who led the movement to be able to get women to drive without having a relative present in the car, when the PR firm was hired by Saudi Arabia to say that that's not a problem, that woman was arrested. In fact, all the original women who went for a drive alone, all of them were arrested. But the U.S. media didn't cover that. When the Saudi Arabian president, and well, the ruler of the kingdom, the crown prince, when he personally gave the orders to execute his critic in the media, he was executed and chopped up in the Turkish embassy, all of which was recorded. Not a thing happened to him. Not a single thing happened. No criticism, no condemnation, no exclusion, nor any of the crimes against humanity that occurred against Yemen, the poorest nation in the Middle East. A minimum of 700,000 children suffering from cholera, malnutrition, and dying, and yet not a single march or demonstration in the United States, not a single condemnation of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, who supported everything, every part of that they were supporting. Without our support, Saudi Arabia would not have continued. That's just as an aside. Now back to what Jeremy is saying. Also, Obama provided weapons to drug cartels in Mexico under the operations Fast and Furious, while ramping up the war on drugs through the Plan Meridia, and oversaw establishment of a clandestine arms pipeline from Libya to Syria by Ambassador Chris Stevens as part of Operation Timber Sycamore. Now, one more thing here. Obama's record as president should not have been surprising given his family's background. This is information that is not hearsay. Jeremy documents this. Quote, his mother, Anne Dunham, worked for the U.S. government agencies and allied NGOs, the Ford Foundation, the Asia Foundation, Development Alternatives, Inc., and the United States Agency for International Development in Indonesia in the 1960s and 70s, as well as Ghana, Nepal, Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, and Thailand, and had training in the Russian language, which, with everything combined, made her a CIA recruiter's wet dream. The microfinancing projects that she worked on to help turn traditional craft industries into sustainable businesses were designed, quote, to tether third world masses to the mentality of finance capitalism, end quote, as Obama's unauthorized biography put it. Dunham's boss at the USAID in Indonesia, Dr. Donald Gordon Jr., author of Credit for Small Farmers in Developing Countries for USAID, was identified as Julius Matter's 1968 book, Who's Who in the CIA, as a CIA agent. Another boss, Peter Geithner, was future Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner's father, and obtained her bachelor's and master's degree in anthropology, University of Hawaii, writing a thesis which argued that Indonesian villagers were dynamic and could produce greater wealth if they had access to market incentives and capital. And so anyhow, it goes into her background and his father's background. And at that time, the CIA employed anthropologists and development workers as undercover agents to gather information on villagers' political affiliations, in which Anne, according to her thesis advisor, Alice Dewey, had taken an interest. And then it goes on further about how she was a part of the American embassy teaching English, which also housed one of the largest CIA stations in Asia and had significant satellite stations around the country. and she also worked for the Indonesian American Friendship Institute in Jakarta, a suspected CIA front. One of her closest colleagues, Adai Sasano, had been the leader of the Muslim students during the overthrow of Sukarno. So it goes on and on, explaining her background, but then it gets into Obama's grandfather, Stanley Armour Dunham, who had helped raise him, served with the 9th Air Force Division, World War II, and it goes into his background and connections. So you start seeing all these threads of connections, and you think, wow, I didn't know this about Barack Obama Sr., and I didn't know about her mother. I didn't know about this because the media has sanitized everything. So they covered up the truth. In effect, quote from the article, Obama and his handlers effectively covered up the truth about Obama's family history. They marketed Obama as a multiracial candidate whose sensitivity to divergent cultures around the world would help restore America's international reputation following the Bush years. Okay. Now, Jeremy, thank you for allowing me to read that. There's a lot more, but would you take it from there as to how Obama was able to get into power and stay in power and never be criticized for anything he did wrong when in power?
Okay, sure. Yeah, well, thanks. Thanks for reading that. Yeah, and actually, there was a lot I didn't know until I took up this research project, because, as you say, this was kind of off. It was something the media wouldn't take up. I think that book, Dreams from My Father, was very crucial. And, there are a lot of distortions in that book. And, it's sad to see that that book is often assigned in college classes. And I don't know if they dissect it critically, but a lot of the information is misleading in that book. But that, created this, mystique about Obama. He graduated from Columbia University. What's odd is that very few people knew him when he was at Columbia, and he appears to have only been there for 1 year and was doing more independent study. And I think he spent some time in Pakistan where his mother was, and he may have been, some suspect he might have been himself recruited to work for the CIA at that time. He was staying at the home of a future Pakistani president. Then he went to work. What he doesn't report, he developed this image as this community organizer and this kind of leftist guy. But after he graduated Columbia, his first major job was with Business International Corporation, which had been, I think, founded by Hubert Humphrey. And it was a CIA, tied corporation that, first it studied business conditions around the world to assist multinational corporations. And it specialized in infiltrating left-wing groups. And that, that was often a cover for CIA activities in foreign countries. And it employed some journalists. And it also had a specialty in infiltrating left-wing groups in countries that the CIA or U.S. government was trying to engage in regime change or manipulate the politics to its liking. So that's who Obama went to work for. But he rarely mentions that. And when he does, he makes he'll say I was a spy behind enemy lines or something, and that he was kind of turned off by the corporate world and became this community organizer. But as a community organizer, he was also working for a large corporate foundation, the Gamaliel Foundation, and those foundations usually had a hidden agenda. And the community organizer, their job really was to kind of divide the working class and divide the country along racial lines, or often focus on very parochial kind of local issues and diffuse broader political activism and radicalism. So there's kind of an agenda behind those corporations in hiring people like Obama to go out as community organizers. And in his case, I think he really played up his accomplishments, and the people were later resentful because he tried to, he was involved with a building where they were fighting asbestos, poisoning in the building. And his role was really minor, but he took all this credit for it, and the people resented him later because he claimed all the credit. And then when he got into office, he never did anything. He didn't even return to visit them. So that seems to be the kind of guy he was. From the people I interviewed and doing the research who knew him, they all said the same thing, that he was just out for his own career and self, and he was not a genuine person. And if you survey his record in the Illinois State House, it was the same. You know, he didn't really support the local community activists. And in fact, he was getting funding from the big shots, you know, in Chicago. And that's where he started his relationship with the Crown family, who was the leading arms manufacturer. That, you know, kind of brings it back to what we were discussing with Yemen and this violent foreign policy, because he was in league, you know, with the Crown family, was a big supporter of his career from his time in Chicago. I guess they saw the potential in him. And, you know, Crown is the major shareholder in General Dynamics, the huge arms maker, made a lot of money off drone technology, war in Afghanistan, war in Yemen. And he was also tied with some seedy people like Tony Rezko, was one of the early funders of his political career in Chicago. And Rezko ended up in jail. And Obama, you know, got a discount deal on his home from Rezko, and it was it looked like a bribe or illicit campaign funding. So, you know, he was doing favors for Rezko when he was an Illinois state senator, because he was involved in the privatization of public housing and promoting that. And then he was helping guys like Rezko buy up housing units. And Rezko is essentially a slumlord. He wouldn't upgrade the apartments, and people were living in very bad conditions, and the rents were going up, and they were getting no upgrades to their apartments, and some had to be evicted. And, you know, Rezko was making money all out of all that, and he was funding Obama. So, you know, Obama was never a very principled person, but I guess people just chose to overlook that. And then when he was, you know, once he got into the presidency, you know, he had some very powerful people supporting him, such as the Crown family. The Pritzker banking dynasty was behind him, in starting from his time in Illinois politics. So these are very, very powerful people who are, you know, providing the finances behind his political rise. And he's doing favors for them constantly, including, you know, when he gets into the presidency, his foreign and domestic policies are catering more to their interest than the public interest.
Jeremy, one last thing here is he had a chance, as all presidents do, to give pardons to all nonviolent drug users who were languishing in prison for years based upon draconian laws, many of those laws the Clintons had started. He did nothing for them. He had a chance to pardon all of the whistleblowers. He didn't. He had a chance during his presidency, especially with the TARP program, which went from $700 billion to, at the end, anywhere from $16 to $20 trillion. All that money went to special interest groups that backed him. None of it went to help individual homeowners get back their home. He didn't de-ghettoize a single city in America. He could easily have done that. He could have had a Marshall Plan, take one city as an example, Newark, Camden, Compton, and he could have shown what would happen if you got the best community organizers, went in there, and reversed it. He didn't do any of that. So when we cannot judge a person based upon the deeds, and as a result, we are praising an illusion of hope and change, then that's on us, not him. Just like it's on us when people trust the Clintons instead of their own eyes and their historical record. Thank you very much for having the courage, as someone who spent their whole life identifying within liberal and progressive causes. I know what it's like to take on one of the icons of the liberal establishment. You, on the other hand, Jeremy, you have taken on many such individuals, and I don't know your current standing within the liberal community, but I want to commend you for your courage and the Covert Action Quarterly and all of its subscribers and its writers for putting the truth out there, irrespective of the political or ideological challenges that are coming back at you.
Thank you. That means a great deal. I appreciate it.
Jeremy Kuzmarov, Kuzmarov, and he is the author of Obama's Unending Wars. And please do yourself a favor. Sign up, go online, and sign up for Covert Action Quarterly and get in the loop of the truth. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening to Progressive Commentary.